From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton, editor-in-chief of the Sacramento Press, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison. Sacramento's pursuit of a new entertainment and sports complex has been going on for nearly 20 years, but it got a big boost from Mayor Kevin Johnson's task force, Think Big Sacramento, which seems to have gotten us closer than we've ever been before. Joining us to talk about this progress is a spokesperson for the task force who's been involved in the arena process in Sacramento for a couple of years. Chris Lehane is a political consultant and spokesperson who's done considerable work in sports, including representing the National Hockey League. He spent the last year guiding this process, so he has a unique perspective on where we are in this long, twisting road, which runs through tonight's city council meeting and will continue on to March 1st when the Maloofs have said they will request a move to Anaheim if Sacramento hasn't come up with a viable plan for a new arena. And as a resident of the Bay Area, Chris also has a unique point of view on Sacramento and how this all looks to an outsider. Chris Lehane, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate your guys' coverage of the issue.
Many people have talked in the last week, came away from the conference last week sort of wondering what exactly was new. There were a lot of different options in this in the so-called menu. What do you think was the big news from last week's press conference?
Well, I think there were a couple of things. You know, first and foremost, we listen to the people. There are no direct taxes in the finance menu of options that we've presented. Secondly, we identified three specific buckets, a private sector contribution, a user fee contribution, those are folks who are actually going to use and benefit from the facility, and a public sector contribution. And across all of those buckets, the common denominator is the fact that all the funding sources that we identified would bear some type of relationship, either direct or indirect, to the facility. What we really want to do is identify funding options that had an inherent connection or relationship, which is why we called the report the Nexus Report. And that put us in a position at the end of the day where we can identify a path forward where the majority of the funding for the arena, you know, will come from the private sector and from the users. And at the end of the day, that's a great opportunity, at least in our view, for the entire region, because it means we're going to be able to leverage private sector money, user fee money, to create a facility that's going to generate 4,000 plus jobs, $7 billion in revenue over 30 years, $150 plus million dollars a year in economic activity for the city of Sacramento. And so it's really trying to be creative and innovative in terms of identifying where we can get revenue to create an enormous economic development opportunity for the region.
Do you understand people's impatience, and there's a lot of skepticism about this out there because it is so complicated, and it is such a lot of money. How do you respond to people? You know, there are a lot of people saying that this is it's a boondoggle. In short,
well, I think what we have attempted to do, and look at it, as you noted at the beginning of your programming, right? There's been an ongoing process for 20 some odd years. You know, I do think that we have put this in a place where there is clearly a viable path forward, a path that's viable from an economic perspective in terms of identifying real revenue streams that can lead to the $400 million that are going to be needed to build this arena, viable and to the extent that these are all legally doable economic revenue sources. And perhaps most importantly of all, these are revenue sources that have public support. We know from our polling and from other sources that these are all revenue sources that we identified that have broad and wide public support. And, you know, I think one of the things that we have benefited from is looking at the experiences of the past. And certainly there was a lot of great work and hard work that went into prior efforts. But ultimately, some of those just came up short, particularly when it came to putting together the political Rubik's Cube in Sacramento. And obviously, you know, there were measures Q and R a couple years ago, and the people spoke clearly do not want to have broad-based taxes paying for this facility. And so what we have done is actually come up with ways to identify money from the private sector and from user fees and put together a puzzle that by definition is going to be innovative, different, creative compared to prior efforts. Now, at the end of the day, this still is going to have to be an economic approach that works for all the parties. It's going to have to work for the NBA and the team. It's going to have to work for the developer of the facility, the operator of the facility. And most importantly, it's going to have to work for the public. But we do think we have identified the different components of the puzzle to be able to get us there, particularly the economic times that we stand in. And I do think it's really important to remember that, you know, we are in enormously challenging economic times nationally, in the state, and in particular in Sacramento, 13% unemployment. This potentially represents the single greatest economic opportunity that the region has faced really since the transatlantic Trans-American Railroad ended in Sacramento. And so from that perspective, I do think it's why we call ourselves Think Big. Sacramento needs to think big, be big, and ultimately act big if it's going to address some of these issues.
Have you been surprised at the resistance on the public on the part of the public, particularly as reflected in the vote a few years ago, to public money being spent on this? After all, it is a presumably a public good to have a big arena complex downtown.
Not at all. I mean, I've done enough of these both political campaigns and stadium arena campaigns to know that generally there is a healthy degree of skepticism from the public. About using public resources to disproportionately pay for a facility that will benefit a professional sports franchise. What we are doing different this time around and why this approach and effort is distinct, and I believe it's one of the reasons why we have received so much support this time around, is that, first of all, this is going to be a facility that is owned by the public. It will be the people's house. And then secondly, we have identified funding sources that are not coming disproportionately from the public. This is a good deal. It's a fair deal. It's a true public-private partnership. Again, based on the information that we put out last week, you can fund this with a majority of the money coming from the private sector and user fees. And so that's just a categorically different approach than has been taken in the past. And the public is smart. They deserve to make sure that they're going to get a return on their investment, that it's a fair deal, that it's an appropriate deal. And I think we've managed to put something together that indeed accomplishes all of those goals.
You mentioned the three buckets at the beginning, private being one, the user fees being another, which is sort of public, but it's targeted to the people who are actually using the arena. And then the third is public. What are those public sources going to be, given that people are very resistant to new taxes?
Yeah, under the three buckets that we put out, the public sector primary contribution would be in the form of providing publicly owned land that the city already controls and owns, including the site at the rail yards where the facility would be built, and a handful of other properties, a number of which would be in the footprint of where the arena would be built. And these are all, for the most part, properties that the city has owned for years where there has been no economic development. One is a dirt patch, the other is a hole in the ground, and a third is a dilapidated, boarded-up building, and these are properties that the city has been trying to sell without success for a long time period. And what we have been told by the experts and other developers is that if an arena is built, these are suddenly properties that will be worth more and that you will be able to attract investment and development dollars into. And so there's an inherent relationship between making available those properties, which otherwise are not getting investments and are not generating revenue for the public, connecting them to the facility, and being able to attract that capital investment and in turn use that to help build facilities. So, really in terms of historic standards, it is a different approach that we're taking. The primary public contribution would be in the form of publicly owned land. And again, we know from our polling that, well over 60% of the public actually thinks that that is a good approach and very consistent with the public-private partnership.
I'm speaking with Chris Lehane, who is the chair of the mayor's Think Big Sacramento Task Force. Regarding the property, this is a bad time to be selling real estate. I understand there's some kind of a mechanism to where you can have the property, let people know the property is available, and then if the arena is going to go ahead, then that automatically raises the potential price of the real estate that is to be sold?
Yeah, there's two potential approaches. One is, again, based on the expert counsel and advice that we have gotten, once you actually move forward with an arena, the properties in and around the arena will, by definition, become properties of interest to developers because they're going to want to be in that area. They're going to clearly recognize that an arena that's going to bring in 3.1 million new people is going to just fundamentally change the economics of those particular properties. So that's one clear path. The other element that we have suggested out there is potentially using what is called EB-5 funding. Mm-hmm. And EB-5 funding in layman's terms or in very simplistic terms, is effectively a home construction loan where you get some money up front and it would basically allow us to have, 4 or 5 years to be able to see if the market comes back. So therefore, if we are making available some of these public properties, you would potentially be selling at a different point in the market. And so it would effectively give the city a great deal of flexibility if it decides it wants to exercise that type of flexibility. Again, at the end of the day, the mere fact that an arena is going to go up will actually increase the value of the properties that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. There was a very critical piece in The Nation magazine a couple of weeks ago that was challenging the notion that arenas are good for cities on a financial level and that they're often best for the people who are the contractors and the people who build them. What is it about Sacramento's situation that makes that that is different?
I think it really comes down to what type of an arena that you're looking at. And you know, by the way, I would distinguish between, you know, arenas and for example, large football stadiums. You know, there's just different economics associated with that. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, if you actually look around at sports arenas where the NBA and the NHL are playing, you know, over the last decade, you know, virtually all of these arenas have relocated into downtown urban markets. In the NBA, all but three teams are in downtown urban markets, and those three are the Detroit Pistons, which are trying to get downtown, the Golden State Warriors, which under their new ownership has talked about going to a more urban environment, and obviously here in Sacramento. And the reason all these facilities have moved downtown is because they often involve some type of public support, some type of public contribution, and the empirical data is very overwhelming. You put these types of arenas in downtown areas, they have an enormous catalytic economic impact. And you've just seen that all over the country, whether it's in Washington, D.C., where what was originally called the MCI Center and now the Verizon Center has basically transformed downtown Washington, D.C. You're seeing that in Denver. You're seeing that in Phoenix. You're beginning to see that already in Los Angeles with the Staples Center. It is a clear pattern across the country that these facilities have had enormous economic impacts when they're located in downtown urban areas. And that's clearly what we're trying to do and what we're looking at in terms of locating this facility at the rail yard, a place that, you know, for more than a generation, you know, has not had any real significant economic development. You know, another region I would suggest that people take a look at, and we're going to be talking more about this on the Think Big side, is what has happened in Kansas City. Kansas City does not even have a professional team, but they put a downtown facility in Kansas City because it was an untapped, underutilized market when it came to entertainment and concerts. And really, in a very short time period, has transformed downtown Kansas City. And the velocity of the dollars moving throughout Kansas City's neighborhoods has been extremely impressive. And again, there's various reports and studies out there that really detail this. You know, I do think at the end of the day, a lot of this will come down to what is, you know, the specifics of the deal. And we have always said that the public needs to be put first. And I think the proposal that we have put out there really does protect the public equities here.
We asked our listeners for questions about the arena, and one of them they asked, which is the big question everybody's asking, is how will this benefit the local economy, particularly in terms of jobs? And you addressed that in your last answer, but sure. In an ongoing sense, just besides construction work.
Well, 4,000 jobs in a time period where there's 13% unemployment, and that's just in the construction alone. That's going to throw off countless other jobs and support countless other big businesses, small businesses, medium-sized businesses throughout the region. We know over the 30-year period of the facility from an economic analysis that we commissioned, it will generate $7 billion. That's seven with a B, billion, in economic development in the region on an annual basis, you know, year in and year out, $150-plus million dollars a year, 3.1 million new people coming to downtown Sacramento who otherwise would not be coming to Sacramento, approximately 300,000 people a year who'd be staying overnight in Sacramento hotels and eating at Sacramento restaurants and staying in Sacramento garages and visiting Sacramento stores. And on top of all of that, you know, one of the things that we have put forth on the Think Big side is a specific proposal to make sure that the actual dollars that are used in the construction, the dollars that will be used in vendors, the dollars that will be associated with the facility actually stay in Sacramento. And we did an announcement, I guess, 3 or 4 weeks ago with a number of the prominent labor leaders in the area, where we actually laid out a very specific approach to make sure that those dollars would stay in Sacramento.
We also got another question from a listener who was asking about the infrastructure costs, because one of the things people are wondering is how you get all of those cars off of the freeway, I-5, and into all these parking lots that are around the arena. How is that going to, is there going to be a need for a new interchange? And if so, how much is it going to cost and who's going to pay for that?
Well, there already is a significant amount of infrastructure going into the area because of the location of the intermodal facility. You know, one of the reasons why we identified the rail yard, well, there are several reasons. You know, one is, as we have talked, basing in an urban environment does have a catalytic economic impact. The second is because the intermodal facility was there, it created a certain synergy, both in terms of a place where people could travel in and out of to be able to go to the arena, but also because the intermodal is serving as a magnet for a significant amount of funds that are already targeted to come in for the infrastructure development. The final piece is, as you raised, there's approximately 8,200 pre-existing parking slots within a quarter to half a mile of the arena where people could park. So the combination of all of those, and we consulted with a number of urban planning experts in the run-up to identifying the rail yards, and the consensus is that this is a very smart place to locate the facility for all the reasons we just talked about.
I was at the press conference last week, and there was no sign that I saw of the Maloofs. Where are they in this whole process?
Well, I would say we were very, very pleased and welcomed, you know, the extremely positive statement that they released shortly after we put out our report. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing it, so this may not be exactly right, but I think they described the report as extremely positive. And it's clear to us, when we did the analysis of the Sacramento market, that Sacramento is indeed a good market from the NBA perspective. And it's interesting when you actually look at the empirical data, which is if you just look at the pure demographics, that's household, income, population, you know, the basics, Sacramento is at the bottom end, or at least the bottom half of the NBA. But when you do what is called the adjusted demographics, which is taking into account that it's the only professional sports team, major professional sports team in the region, then it actually ends up being a much stronger market, particularly on the TV side. Using the adjusted demographic profile, it ends up being the number one TV market in the NBA. Having said all of that, one of our challenges is that the region does have a very small corporate base compared to other NBA and really even NHL markets. And for that reason, this cannot be completely privately funded as it is in LA. Nor is it fair to have it completely publicly funded. So what we really try to do is get to the sweet spot in terms of the public-private partnership that we identified. But going through the process and really understanding what the market could support and how it could support it, I think was enormously helpful and informed the types of numbers that we identified.
Another question we had from listeners was the Think Big Sacramento itself, and people like you have been spending a lot of time on this. How much money has been spent in putting this whole thing together, and where is that money coming from?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the benefits of Think Big is that it is a non-taxpayer-funded, non-publicly funded entity. So this is, you know, a combination of folks who have been willing to help support it by through private contributions and corporate contributions, and really, to a large extent, volunteer contributions. You know, the task force consists of over 60 folks. You know, there's business, there's labor, there's folks from the city, people from the region, Democrats, Republicans. You know, I've even joked, I think there's probably Giants and Dodgers fans on this. But all these folks, are really, serving as volunteers. And we've been able to tap into some tremendous expertise to be able to take the steps that we have taken and identify the information that we've identified.
But for people who are not volunteering, for people who are professionals, where's the Think Big money coming from?
Sure, all that money comes from private donations.
Okay. Any particular large donors?
For the most part, we went out and talked to folks who have been significant sponsors, season ticket holders, corporate sponsors of the Kings. And really, it's been, a little bit here and a little bit there from a whole variety of folks who, who are really interested in trying to see this project come to fruition. But again, the huge bulk of the effort here really has been what I would call sweat equity, mm-hmm. people putting in their own time and their own effort into this.
I've been speaking with Chris Lehane, who's the chair of the Mayor's Arena Task Force. One last question, which is, we've got about 5.5 months now until March 1st. What is the next big hurdle for you?
Well, obviously, it is, a number of the issues need to be determined by the city council and city government. They're obviously the elected officials of the area. It's their responsibility. Our role was to have identified the funding, the menu of funding options and a potential approach. And so the city is going to be making decisions. There's a council meeting tonight. I think some of the issues that they will be looking at will include, do they enter into an agreement with a developer with a so-called, exclusive right to negotiate over a specific time period? Do they then use that to be able to go out and identify an operator? The single most important aspect in all of this is going to be getting into the room with the NBA and the Kings and really having a discussion to make sure that the economics can work for everyone. Because a lot of that will flow from those discussions. And the three buckets I identified, it's very likely that money could go back and forth in different ways between those. But at the end of the day, I do think that we have a proposal out there that is viable, and the step forwards are pretty clear.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris Lehane. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And again, appreciate all the time that you guys have devoted to this subject.
You're welcome. Thank you. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Nick Miller and I discuss local news. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight is also online, and joining us to tell us more about that is senior producer Jen Picard. Morning, Jen.
Hey, good morning. Well, we'd actually like to hear your thoughts on the new sports and entertainment complex in downtown Sacramento. Do you think it's going to happen this time? And how would you like to see it done? Send us an email to insight@capradio.org or comment on our Facebook page, Insight at Capital Public Radio. And tomorrow, we'll be talking with a local reporter about a new study out of Stanford University that suggests your medical treatment depends greatly on where you actually live in California. Has this been your experience? If you live in a smaller town or far away from metropolitan areas, do you have a harder time getting the treatment you need? We'd like to hear your stories. Again, you can comment on our Facebook page, Insight at Capital Public Radio, or email insight@capradio.org.
Thanks, Jen.
You're welcome.
Each week at this point, I usually join Jeffrey to discuss local news, but since I'm being Jeffrey this week, playing the part of David Watts Barton, is Nick Miller from Sacramento News and Review. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me, David.
Well, you just heard Chris Lehane talking about the arena. What are you guys looking at down there at News and Review?
Well, let's just put aside what we think, and I'm going to do what my girlfriend says I do best, and that's play devil's advocate. And so it comes down to this, right? It's like, why is an arena the best way to spend $100 million public dollars? As opposed to investing in mass transit for the future, as opposed to creating a green manufacturing center sector, investing in urban density, music venues, you know, who knows what. Are we going to get the return over the long term? The NBA is not in, as far as its business operations, is losing, hemorrhaging hundreds of millions of dollars a year. As so long as the Maloofs are owning the team, they're going to spend $30 to $40 million a year to put players on the court, whereas you have Dallas and the Lakers spending $80, $90 million a year. Mm-hmm. Will that put butts in the seats after the first year? Who knows? I think it comes down to the parking lots, the city-owned parking lots, and AEG, which is the Anschutz Entertainment Group, mm-hmm. who invested $50 million in Kansas City's arena, the one Chris Lehane was just speaking about. Mm-hmm. If they can put up some money, fine. You know, that'll pay for the initial construction costs. It might be worthwhile. But if we have to sell 8,000 city-owned off-street parking spaces to a private person, why are we going to spend that money on an arena? I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, David, but I think there needs to be a dialogue about that mm-hmm. before we make that decision.
All right. Well, that's going to be going on for quite a while now.
It will. It
will,
several
more months. In other news, we just heard yesterday that Red Lotus on J Street, which is a real fine Chinese restaurant, closed its doors on Sunday night. And this is the most recent in quite a few restaurants that we're hearing about closing. What are you looking at out there?
Well, it's sad. I mean, we've probably made the list. We have Red Lotus. We have L Wine Lounge, Celestine's, Brew It Up, Spin Burger Bar, Good Eats. Mm-hmm. But for me, like, Red Lotus is, everyone says, oh, we need brave, bold restaurants in Sacramento that push the envelope. I mean, he brought in a dumpling guy to make handcrafted, quote unquote, artisan dumplings. Mm-hmm. And but it just goes to show that's a hard sell mm-hmm. in Sacramento. You know, we want brave, bold new things, but do the diners come out to support it? Obviously not as much as it took or is needed.
And I'll play devil's advocate here for a second. I think all of these restaurants closed for different reasons. Celestine's, they've been open for 28 years, and the couple that owns it basically wants to take mm-hmm. take a little time off and have a life. Brew It Up, I'm not exactly sure exactly what. L Wine Bar is supposedly a temporary closing, and they're going to reopen again. Mm-hmm. So I guess we have to be careful of jumping on, like, there's a Armageddon of restaurants in downtown Sacramento.
No, that's true. But I mean, we have to talk about the airport, obviously. And it's like, mm-hmm. if you look at the restaurants we're putting into the new Terminal B at the Sacramento airport, I think that's pretty representative of what Sacramento's like. You know, we have Jack's Urban Eats. We have Esquire Grill, you know, pretty safe burger, steaks and salads. I mm-hmm. mean, they're not putting a dumpling spot in there. Or,
but to be fair, it's an airport.
That's true. But yeah, I mean, well, if you go to Dallas, you're going to get some Dickie's barbecue, or, you know,
right.
people are going to mix it up. So I think the airport is representative of the regional fare, and you know, we're not going outside of the box too much, so to speak.
something that they did preview yesterday, which we had today in Sacramento Press, and everybody's going to have out there, is all the new art. There's a lot of public art, and a lot of it's just absolutely spectacular. Have you had a chance to go see it or talk to anybody?
I did not. We're on deadline on Monday, but I was very grateful that your reporter, Brandon Darnell, went there with his trusty camera, played Shutterbug, and he has some great shots up on sacpress.com right now. And, you know, you got to commend SMAC, because it's like, it just shows that if the Board of Supervisors give money for SMAC to invest in art projects, they're going to deliver. The Rabbit, called it's called Leap, and it's by a Denver-based artist, Lawrence Argent, and it's a giant rabbit made of about 1,600 aluminum triangles in red, and it's hanging over the ticket booths. I think it's awesome. It has energy. It has motion. It's really cool. I guess there's a little Zen room at the airport now. There's local artists as well. Gregory Condos has Sutter's Gold, one of his more famous paintings. There's a mural by Suzanne Aden called Flying Colors that's just beautiful.
And Joan Moment, right?
Yeah, I think they knocked it out. And I love the original, the Tower of Suitcases at the original terminal.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it just goes to show, if you're investing in the arts, SMAC is going to deliver for you. And I think we should, you know, let's find some more money for them. Let's see what else they can do.
And the Tower of Suitcases is something that people notice and they travel through, and the Rabbit's going to be the same thing. And people say, why invest in public art? Because people go through and they say, oh, that's the airport with the giant rabbit, or that's the airport with the stack of suitcases.
Correct, yeah. Oh, it's not, oh, you're the city with the worst basketball team in the entire country.
Speaking of food, over by the Oak Park Med Center, there's a new McDonald's going in. There's been quite a bit of controversy on it. We've covered it quite a bit. What's your take on that?
It's interesting, right? The residents don't want it because they're very, very focused on getting nutritional and healthy food in there. The city, however, is worried that the drive-through is going to create too much traffic for a high-density pedestrian area. So really, it's not about healthy food for the city's planning commission. It's about a little drive-through window. So the fate of that McDonald's is going to go in front of the planning commission in early October. And McDonald's has never built a franchise in the Sacramento area without a drive-through window. So on one hand, you're going to get 50 jobs. You know, you're going to get some life on that empty lot that's been, I don't know if you know the area, but it's been vacant as long as I can
remember. Yeah,
so it would be nice to have something there. But I'm not sure McDonald's is the answer.
And then one other subject that you guys have covered, this, and it's also on the city council agenda tonight, I believe, is this new trash waste disposal contract the city's looking at.
Yeah. A company, BLT, is going to transfer their waste contract to Waste Management, and Waste Management's based out of Folsom, and it's the largest publicly traded company in the Sacramento area. But it's interesting because the CEO recently stated he's just so fed up with business in California, so fed up with the red tape and the legislature, that he's threatening to move to Nevada or Texas. Meanwhile, the city of Sacramento, and it's looking like city council, is going to green light giving Waste Management a monopoly over all three sectors of our city's waste management. That's going to give us a little wiggle room insofar as negotiating price, where we dispose of this trash, and you know, just kind of maximizing the economic efficiency of what we spend our money on. So it's like, I don't know. I think everything, we just got to step back and look at the long term here. And I feel like we're just locking into decisions that maybe just needs a little second guessing.
So, and that'll be on the agenda at city council
tonight? That is tonight, in addition to the card room ordinance in the arena.
Right. And then finally, this last weekend, it passed without a whole lot of note, but this is the one-year anniversary of the murder at Second Saturday, which caused such a lot of fuss in downtown and a lot of concern. How has Second Saturday rebounded a year later?
You know, I was worried this summer because May, June, July, it was kind of quiet. The weather was a little unfavorable, but September was really strong. You know, I live on N Street, and I kind of I go out and walk my dog during Second Saturday and check it out. But I also look down from my balcony to see how the parking spaces are doing, and that's kind of a nice way to kind of evaluate turnout. And it was a strong Second Saturday, so I'm really happy for Midtown and the NBA and the galleries and the bars and the restaurants. So I'm looking forward to the next summer. You know, let's keep it going. Let's take away the red tape and permit as many artists and vendors out there, and let's have a good fun party once a month on Second Saturday.
Yeah, and it'll be back in October next month.
That's the good part.
All right. Nick Miller, News and Review, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks always.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, new research by graduate and undergrad students at UC Davis. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison, who is on vacation. It's time to check in with on today's news with senior editor Alan Ray. He joins us from the newsroom. What's the news today, Alan?
Well, good morning. Carmichael, which is kind of like a city, but not quite, has something like a main street, but not quite, because Fair Oaks Boulevard isn't exactly your bucolic downtown street. Tonight, the County Board of Supervisors considers changes to the boulevard as it passes through Carmichael to make it more pedestrian and bike-friendly. And coming up on All Things Considered this afternoon, the nation's poverty rate up to 15.1% in 2010. That's the highest since 1993. The most arresting number may be the one that shows 22% of the nation's kids living below the poverty line. Those stories and more on All Things Considered beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on Capital Public Radio.
All right. Thanks, Alan. UC Davis is home to a wide variety of research projects between professors, graduate students, and even undergraduates. Joining me now are one of each who presented their findings at a symposium in Davis yesterday. Their projects include studying different aspects of health, including the effects of fragrances on people and the environment, and the need for certain microbes in the digestive systems of infants. Joining me today are Meredith Niles, a graduate student who is studying the effects of fragrance in personal care products, and Jason Harville, who is studying applied mathematics in the natural sciences. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Also joining us is Rick Grossberg, who is a faculty advisor on both projects and whose special interest is in simple organisms in the ocean that might teach us more about complicated organisms like ourselves.
Thanks, David.
Welcome. Rick, before we get into the specifics, would you give us an overview of the two projects that these two students are working on?
So I coordinate two interdisciplinary research programs, one for graduate students called the IGRT program. That's the Integrative Graduate Research and Education Traineeship sponsored by the National Science Foundation, as well as the CLIMB program. That's the Collaborative Learning at the Interface of Mathematics and Biology, also funded by the National Science Foundation. And both of these programs aim to teach undergraduates and graduate students to work in highly collaborative interdisciplinary research programs. That's viewed by the National Science Foundation as the future of much of scientific research, crossing what were once very hard, fast disciplinary boundaries. And so these programs aim to give these students at various levels of their academic experience a chance to work together and talk and conduct research with people outside of their own disciplines.
And that's partly because the nature of doing research is that you focus on something very, very, very specific, particularly at the graduate level, right?
That's exactly right. So most graduate students typically focus on a narrow project that's disciplinary, but it's become clear that major research breakthroughs now are happening through collaborations between people working in very different disciplines, and not just in the natural sciences, but between the natural sciences and the social sciences, for example.
Oh, okay. Well, let's talk to Meredith Niles in a little bit. You're working on a project with fragrances and how they affect people, I'm assuming, in people's health, but also the environment, which in turn affects people's health and a lot of other creatures' health. What's your focus on, in that? What do you focus on to study?
Sure. So my group, there's five of us, five graduate students, and what we decided to focus on was fragrance chemicals in personal care products. And there's a lot of research that's showing increasingly that some of these chemicals have negative human health impacts as well as environmental impacts. But what research hasn't really been done is understanding the behavior behind why people choose the products that they do and how that might have implications for their health and the environment. And so we actually did a study of 1,500 people nationwide, a random sample, to really try to understand how people are choosing these products, what variables affect that, and what their behaviors are, and how that ultimately might affect the environment and their own health.
So you're not actually taking apart the elements of a particular perfume or deodorant or whatever. You're looking at how people choose what they're buying.
That's right. Yeah, we actually decided, you know, there's a great amount of research from an ecotoxicology perspective and a human health perspective to really understand what some of the impacts might be on people and the environment. Where we really saw the lack of research was really in the behavior and the social science side of this research. And so our project really tried to aim to understand from a social science perspective as well as a natural science perspective what drives people's behaviors and how might those behaviors be affecting the environment as well as affecting their own human health.
And what are some of the things that you found?
Sure. Well, one thing that we found that was really interesting was that a lot of people, actually about two-thirds of people, read the ingredient label on their personal care product. Mm-hmm. And the majority of people actually support the government to require companies to list all of the ingredients on their personal care product. But in fact, the government doesn't require any companies to list all of the ingredients on their personal care product. Mm. So here we see a situation where people are really interested in knowing this information, and we found that people who had that information more often chose organic and natural products and unscented products that might be better for the environment and their own health. And yet here we have a policy that's in place that prevents that from happening.
And do you make recommendations in terms of what you think who would this be covered by, FDA or?
It's FDA for the most part, yes.
And do you make recommendations based on this, or at least amongst yourselves, or are you actually going to communicate with the FDA about this?
Sure. Well, we're certainly looking at the policy implications of our research, and we're actually giving our workshop on this Friday at UC Davis, and we've been in touch with a number of different policymakers, government agency people are coming and attending, and so we're working collaboratively because we think that's part of the process here, is communicating outside of academia and outside of scientists to policymakers about the implications of our research and what might be some of the steps they could take to create more effective policies.
And what might some of those steps be?
Well, I certainly think that our research supports labeling and disclosure of information and ingredients for people, not only because it gives people the right to know and the choice to choose products that have certain chemicals or ingredients or not, but also because our results suggest that people that have that information will choose more environmentally friendly and human health friendly behaviors.
We're talking about projects at UC Davis and research projects that are regarding human health and different aspects of it. Also here is Jason Harville, who's you study mathematics, is that right?
Yes, applied mathematics.
Applied mathematics. And what's the project that you've been working on?
What we've done is we've constructed a mathematical model to examine how the bacteria, the good and the bad bugs that are in our digestive tract, how they establish, how that community comes to be, because it really is it's like a forest or a rainforest in there. It's a diverse ecosystem, and it's really not well understood to date. And so we created a model to try to lend insight into researchers in this field.
And that's something that a lot of people are paying more attention to. You see probiotics, mm-hmm. and things like that people are much more interested in buying. People are more aware of things like yogurt and some of the bacteria in yogurt in terms of digestion. What have you found that was interesting to you or surprised you?
Well, I think the biggest take-home message is that this matters. I mean, if you look at just, say, as a cell count, we have something on the order of 10 times the number of bacterial cells on and in our bodies than we do human cells. So we're really more bacteria with a little sprinkle of human in there to hold it all together, if you want to look at it that way. And the majority of these bugs, for good or for worse, reside in our digestive tracts. And if you look at it that way, it's the largest organ in the human body and also one of the least understood. And there's a wide range of empirical evidence that this really matters for human health, and it matters for infants in particular, and not only in the health of infants, but possibly in a range of long-term health issues.
What specifically about infants? Because that was sort of the thing that grabbed us about this, is that you're studying the guts of human babies, mm-hmm. and what's in there. Because we think of them, if they're nursing, then they're not getting much in the way of bacteria. If they're nursing, how does that work?
Well, that makes sense to think of it that way, but actually there's a researcher described it yesterday as giving birth being a microbially intensive process, which is a delicate way of putting it, but we're exposed right away, and possibly even prior to birth, but definitely from birth, we're exposed to bugs in our environment all around us. There's microbes, there's potentially bacteria in a mother's breast milk, but definitely on her skin. And just through the process of breastfeeding, the baby ingests actually a lot of bacteria. And this is where it starts, because the baby begins either sterile or really close to sterile inside of its digestive system. And the establishment of this community can be a tricky thing, because you want to make sure that the good guys are winning.
Mm. Well, congratulations on your work and giving your papers. That's terrific.
Thank you.
Thanks
very much for coming in.
Thank you, David.
You're listening to Inside on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Coming up, a new book that promises to help kickstart weight loss in 21 days. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. It'll be mostly sunny in the Sacramento Valley today with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the foothills. The highs will be around 90. There's a flood watch in effect in Reno and Tahoe with a chance of isolated showers and heavy rains. And in Omaha, Nebraska, it's expected to be partly cloudy with temperatures in the mid-70s this evening as the Sacramento River Cats face the Omaha Storm Chasers in the first game of the Pacific Coast League Championship Series. Dr. Neil Barnard is one of this country's leading advocates for good nutrition. He's an adjunct professor at George University School of Medicine, and he has conducted numerous studies on the effect of diet and health. He's also published 14 books on the subject, including his latest book, 21-Day Weight Loss Kickstart. He'll be speaking tonight at The Artisan on Del Paso Boulevard, but right now he's in our studio. Dr. Barnard, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's great to be with you today.
Why does the world need another diet book?
What we really need is a guide to how to use foods intelligently that's based on solid research and that really has been tested and works. Because as you're sort of implying with your question, people have gotten all sorts of false leads. People have gone low carb and they've done every kind of thing. And not only is the failure of that leading us to be heavier, and we're in the worst shape as a country than we have ever been. And our kids are in the worst shape of any generation we have ever had in the history of this planet. But it also affects us psychologically, because when we fail at our dieting attempt, we start to think that there's something wrong with us. There's nothing wrong with you. What's wrong is with the diet. So what we did was we looked around the world and said, who actually is healthier? What are the diet patterns that seem to promote that? And we have found answers to that. And then we in our research center put these to the test, see what works. And then the third step is you see, how can you make it simple so that somebody like me — I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, come from a cattle ranching family, eating 100% the wrong things. How can anybody sort of apply this and make it work? So that's what we do.
And looking at the book, it looks like you're essentially talking about a vegan diet, right?
Totally plant-based, entirely.
And so how is that different? We can get into the benefits of that, but how is that different than sort of a low-carb diet or a high-protein diet if you're going all the way and eliminating a whole group of foods that a lot of people are pretty accustomed to eating, which is like dairy, eggs, meat, chicken, et cetera?
Right. If you look around the world, the people who are the healthiest and live the longest and have the least diabetes are people who do not eat the way I did as a kid growing up in Fargo, which was meat was the main feature of our diet. But if you look at, say, rural Japan, their main staple is rice, huge amounts of rice. And that didn't change until the fast food places started invading Tokyo and Osaka. And you know what they say, when you see the golden arches, you're on the road to the pearly gates. Well, that has been true for Japan, where diabetes has gone through the roof. Within this country, say within California, when people study different diet patterns, the people who eat meat every day are the heaviest by far and the most diabetes. The people who never eat meat or any animal products are the thinnest and in the healthiest range. And the other groups, like people who eat just fish or dairy but no meat at all, they kind of slot in between. Mm-hmm. So in other words, plant-based diet, it leads people to be the healthiest, live the longest, and so forth. The question then is, does that really work? If I take a person who had never done any diet like that before, never even wanted to, and I transform their diet, how would it work? So we did a study. We brought in 64 women. They were all overweight. After the age of menopause, they all felt stuck. They just couldn't lose weight. So we said, okay, two rules. No animal products at all. So breakfast could be blueberry pancakes with maple syrup. That's okay. A big bowl of oatmeal with cinnamon and raisins, that would work. And for lunch, if you have chili, it's not going to be the meat chili. It'll be the bean chili or a chunky vegetable chili. If you're going Italian for dinner, you're not going to have the meat sauce all over your spaghetti. It'll be seared oyster mushrooms and chunky tomatoes or whatever. It's going to be all vegetarian. By the way, alcohol for these people was in the fruit group, so that was okay. And they could have the espresso at the end. So those were the rules. And the participants in the study all began the diet. 14 weeks later, we put them all on the scale. Despite the fact that there was no caloric limit, they could eat as much as they wanted. There was no exercise. What we found was that they actually ended up losing weight about 13 pounds per person in over a 14-week period. Your average person lost 13 pounds, which is about a pound a week, some more, some less. But then the most important thing is we then brought them in a year later. We found they were thinner at a year than at the beginning, and we brought them in 2 years later. They were thinner at 2 years than at 1 year. So, in other words, unlike every other kind of diet they'd ever been on, they were never hungry, they were never rebounding, the weight never returned. So there's something about switching qualitatively what you're eating, as opposed to thinking all quantity. I've just got to eat less. Forget eating less. If you're eating plant-based foods, they tend to slim you down. And then we did some studies to sort out why that happens in the body, and we now know why it works.
But I have to say that everything you mentioned, except maybe the blueberry pancakes, I wanted to put cheese on.
You know, and let me say something. If cheese were any worse, cheese is 70% fat. 70% fat. And it is not good fat. It's saturated fat. Mm-hmm. That's the kind that causes heart problems. If it were any worse, it would be Vaseline. And people eat so much of it, and we feed it to our children. One day that is going to be referred to as child abuse, because I know everyone thinks, oh, cheese, isn't it wonderful? For some reason, nobody is noticing that this is the major dairy products in general are the main source of saturated fat in Americans' diets. It is the one thing that every researcher agrees you don't need and shouldn't have. And for some reason, it's in schools, it's all over the place. Your average American eats 34 pounds of cheese every year.
But that's because we like it so much.
And that's why
it
we
tastes
are fat.
Good. I'm saying all this because I want to know, how do we get past that desire that you're not going to feel like you're having a complete meal unless you put some of the... I mean, a lot of people can let go of meat, but cheese is a lot harder for people.
Yeah, and there's a reason for that. And I was struck by that in our research studies. Why is it that people crave cheese? And here's why. The dairy protein is called casein, C-A-S-E-I-N. Mm-hmm. It's a long protein made of amino acids, like beads in a chain. And when your body breaks it apart in the digestive process, the casein breaks into what are called casomorphins. Casomorphins are casein-derived, morphine-like compounds. They are opiates. Mm-hmm. They attach in your brain to the very same receptors that heroin would attach to. Don't get me wrong. You're not going to dance on a table. You're not going to go into a back alley to get your next cheese dose. But the most potent of them is it has about 1/10 the binding power of pure morphine. So what I'm going to suggest is that people are hooked on sugar, chocolate, cheese, and meat. But nobody ever went to the 7-Eleven at 9 o'clock at night to buy cauliflower or to buy an apple or an orange. We may like these foods, but they don't have any addicting potential.
Mm-hmm. And we're very short on time, but I wanted to talk just briefly about the book. The title is The 21-Day Weight Loss Kickstart. Give us a real quick idea about the kickstart aspect of this.
The whole idea is how can I really change my diet? So the first step is don't change your diet. Take a week and just sort out what you would like for breakfast or lunch or dinner. That happens to be no animal products, oil's very low. So oatmeal or pancakes or chili or spaghetti toppings, whatever. Then the second step is you take a 3-week period that I refer to as the kickstart. And it's going to be all vegan all the time, but only 21 days. And anyone can do that. At the end of that time, what they discover is, A, they are healthy, they're losing weight, they're feeling better. But B, their tastes are actually changing. So we do an online program now where we have right now at this moment about 20,000 people all doing vegan. We started September 5th and they're going for 3 weeks. In November, we're doing Kickstart India. In March, we're doing Kickstart China in Mandarin.
Wow.
Because China's the biggest country in the world, India second, and they are westernizing their diets, and they have obesity and diabetes that is now unprecedented. So if people are interested in that, I'll give our website if I may. It's pcrm.org. PCRM.org is Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. See the Kickstart icon. Sign up totally free. Every day you get the emails that they are getting with little cooking demonstrations, menus, tips, celebrities like Alicia Silverstone pumping you up and making you feel skinny. And it really works.
All right. Well, and you'll be speaking tonight at the Artisan on Del Paso Boulevard.
The Artisan at 1901 Del Paso Boulevard. Bring your reluctant spouse. We're all going to get healthy together.
All right. Well, Dr. Barnard, thanks for coming in.
Sure. Thank you very much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton of the Sacramento Press. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Liz Cazares. Insight's assistant producer is James Morrison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. And thank you for joining us. Does medical treatment depend on where you actually live in California? A new study says it does. On the next Insight, we'll talk about geographic disparities in medical treatment and how it might affect you. Also, music producer and Yuba City native Charlie Peacock. His latest group, The Civil Wars, has hit it big. We'll talk with him about his work and why he loves his hometown. I'm David Watts Barton. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.